Thank you, Teresa, for your terrific singing and for you personally. We appreciate you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, yes, Teresa, she's worth sitting out in the hot sun for. Welcome to Warbirds in Review. We're coming to the last part of the week, and it keeps getting better. So my name is Connie Boland. I am the founder and now the coordinator for Warbirds in Review. But as you might imagine, a production to this level takes a lot of people, and we have to start with the Sleeping Dog production crew. I think they might be in the control room now where they could wave at you if not now. There's Scott, Lance, and Andy, I think, back there in the control room. So thank you, guys. There they are. That's our control room where they work and do all this. Yes, they deserve a hand. And, of course, all our volunteers, Karen, and all these people who help out. And we could not do this without the sponsorship of Scott's Miracle-Gro Company. And I don't know, maybe if I find another sponsor, we could get a cover for the bleachers next year. So when So I'll pass the hat here, and maybe all of you who are regulars can help us out with that. Sorry it's so hot, but that is Wisconsin. Cold one day, hot the next day. So this is what we have. Also, the room behind us that you just saw where the guys are working, that is in the Fagan Hut. We call it the Quonset Hut, that donated by Ron and Diane Fagan. We thank them very much for their continued support. If you are ever just passing through Granite Falls, Minnesota, it kind of has to be a destination, so you're not probably passing through, but it's well worth the extra effort. Their World War II Fighter Museum there is the best I have ever been to, and I've been to a lot of museums. The rest of this week, once the Corsairs leave this afternoon off the alley, we're going to fill Warbird Alley with Vietnam aircraft. So basically the rest of this week is going to be dedicated to Vietnam, our Vietnam veterans, and all who served in Vietnam. So I'm glad you're here, and I saw the clapping there. It is appropriate that we recognize Vietnam in the biggest way that we can and say welcome home to all those guys who served over there, and ladies. Just for your information, the Corsairs will be taxiing out a little later on and be taxiing down Show Center to be part of the show. So that's going to be a pretty cool thing. Right after this is their proposed start time, but things are always a moving target here. The aircraft we have today represent Vietnam, so I'm going to leave it to our program to tell you all about that. But I'd also like to thank Breitling. Speaking of sponsorships, Breitling Watches donated a watch to us, which we will be raffling at a later time. So stay tuned for that information. But we are very appreciative of Breitling's support this year, and we hope they'll come back next year in a bigger way. But look for a raffle somehow when we figure out how we're going to do that. But thanks to Breitling for doing that. And now, if I haven't forgotten anything, I'll just direct you to the introductory video that tells you a little bit about these airplanes and the veterans who flew them. When that is finished, General Ed McElhenney will come out when he'll introduce our guest. Ed McElhenney is our moderator and doing a great job. We're not going to let him quit. He's doing too great here. So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome, and I thank you for being here during the heat, and if you'll direct your attention to the video screen, Jumbotron. Thank you.
All right. Ed, sure. Go ahead. Grab a seat there.
All right.
Phil, you can take the next one, then we'll give Alan and Yang Chi the last two. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ed McElhenney. I'll be the moderator for the program this afternoon. Thanks for being here. Appreciate it. I'm happy to say that we've got a little overcast to keep things a little cooler, which is a very good thing. I'm looking forward to today's program. It should be very interesting. We've got several people here with combat time, and I'll introduce each one of them individually. The first guy we got here is Ed Fairchild. He is one of the 01 kind of guys, and flew in Vietnam, 1,000 hours or so, something like that, flying time, is that right?
I'm sorry?
1,000 hours of 01 time, somewhere along there?
985 hours, okay. 566 missions.
All right, 985 hours of combat time, okay? The next guy, we got Phil Phillips over there. We can't talk about his mission. I'm sorry. We're just going to shut him up. No. He was a Sneaky Pete kind of guy, and he also has, I don't know, around 1,000 hours of combat time in the old one?
A little less, but okay. Kind of lost count.
So between the two of them, we got almost 2,000 hours of combat time in an O-1, in L-19. Next guy is our T-28 expert, Alan Cook, and he's going to talk a little bit about the airplane and all that. But and you're kind of going, okay, what's going on here? We got an O-1 and we've got, hey, a T-28. Well, and that's where the Hmong come in. And yeah, Yang Chi, I'll let Alan introduce Yang Chi. Go ahead.
So Yang Chi is one of our board members from the National Lao Hmong Memorial Foundation, and he's here to speak to the involvement of the Hmong in the war.
Okay, and we're going to have like three separate little portions here. We're going to get Ed to talk a little bit about his flying in the O-1, which was I'm not saying yours was illegitimate, but it was it was somewhere else. It was legitimate flying in the O-1 in Vietnam, and he'll talk to his support of the Arvin Airborne. Next, we're going to get into to Phil and what they did. And it's not classified anymore, but everybody at this point should realize that, you know, yeah, the war was Vietnam, but, oh, there was something else going on over there, and it was in Laos and Cambodia. And it was, you know, this morning we talked about the forgotten war, as in Korea, okay? And now we're going to talk a little bit about the secret war and the secret war that went on in Laos and Cambodia. And Phil was one of the guys who did that. And so he'll be able to speak to that that classified mission at that time and what he did there. And part of that, and the follow-on after that, of course, was, hey, the T-28 and what those guys did over there, which to me was just absolutely incredible. Some of the missions they flew, the number of missions per day, the total number of missions, absolutely. What was the motto? Fly until you die, you yep. know? And that's what they did, and that was for their country. So with that, I'm going to open it up to Ed, and he's going to talk a little bit about, hey, and at the end, by the way, we'll do a quick walk around on each airplane, and then we'll have some questions that y'all can ask after that. But for right now, I'm just going to ask Ed just to briefly describe where he flew the O-1 and some of the details on his missions that he had there. So, Ed, you got it.
All right, I'm Ed Fairchild, and I flew for the United States Air Force. I flew L-19s in South Vietnam. Got over there by a slightly different route. I did a bunch of time in B-52s as a navigator, went through pilot training, ended up in a L-19 flying forward air controller for the Vietnamese Airborne Division. And so what that really means is simply this. Wherever the airborne went, that's where we went. And whatever they needed in the way of air support or artillery support, we provided that. We adjusted the guns for artillery input, and then we also would handle the airstrike. On the airstrike, we'd have three radios in the airplane. UHF, we were working the fighters on that one. The VHF is what we use for the control of other fighters coming in. And then we would have talking on a FM radio when you're talking with the folks on the ground. So they would give us a mark so we know about where it is that we're working and what our objective is. We check in with our senior person on the red markers and the red hats. Red hats were the ground advisors with the Airborne Division. And Vietnam only had that one Airborne Division. And so it was used in a special forces arrangement such that wherever in the country there was a real active engagement with the enemy, they would have the excess help they had was coming from the airborne troops. So we would, sometimes you're working in the northern part of Vietnam, sometimes you're working in the southern part. So it just depended on who needed what and where and when. And so you would then fly in direct support with those folks. When I first got over there, I was working out of a rubber plantation with the Australians on a combined operation with the Vietnamese Airborne, the Australian troops, and also the U.S. troops. We spent a couple months working that, and the primary advisor I was talking with was Red Hat 1-1. So these guys, when you first got over there, they wanted to set up a personal relationship between you and them. They wanted us to know their wife's name, the children, so that when we were working with those folks on the ground, it was not a disengagement with the people. It was your friend on the ground, and now you had a personal relationship with those folks. So they worked hard at setting that relationship up, and quite correctly so. And so I was complaining about the artillery shooting at me most of the time. So if the artillery's coming in, it's coming down from somewhere, and if I'm in the middle, it's coming past me, and that's not real nice some days. So you want to make sure you know where things are. And so he was razzing me a little bit, telling me that he could come down and walk around in a jungle with him. Well, I wasn't going to do that, but I volunteered to take him for a flight. And so a few months later, we got together, and I ended up taking him up a bunch of times. He ended up going to the Army Aviation Corps. He said, I'm not walking around that jungle anymore.
So, smart man.
So there was a real tight relationship between the Vietnamese Airborne. They were good people, both officer and enlisted folks. They were great folks, and they did a good job.
What kind of ordnance were you using? What were you shooting? What were you dropping?
I was armed with 2.75-inch smoke rockets. I had four on each wing. This airplane you see has got two. And then we also had a row of flares, actually smoke grenades, that were on the back of the seat. And so when you run out of rockets, you reach back and grab one of those grenades, and you put it in your left hand, and you stuck it out the window. It did not come back in the airplane.
Did you carry a rifle with you, too?
Yeah, we carried an AR-15. We carried a pistol and a knife or two, just for good measure. But you never used those in flight. You didn't need that. You had all kinds of stuff that you needed to shoot the enemy with, and you needed to control that. Very intense environment in the fight area. When you're airborne in there with the fighters running around and yourself, and then you got the intersection of all these airplanes, and you got a lot of information flowing between things. So it's very difficult and time-consuming to do it correctly in the cockpit. Absolutely mandatory that you do that. You kill people if you don't. And so at any rate, I ended up flying with those guys for about 9 months out of the 12 months I was over there, and flew as a sector of ALO for a little while, and learned how to really appreciate the support, the ground support that was provided by the ARVN, because when you're out in the sector, it was all yours. At one point, I had three airplanes, three pilots, myself, and 30 minutes worth of gas to support a whole division. So we had to build our own refueling facility. At any rate, when I was with the Royal Red Markers, that we got all that support taken care of. And so I ended up flying 566 missions, and I never took a single round in an airplane.
Okay, and in saying that, you had specific techniques to being missed, to avoid being hit. You described some of your roll-in techniques. If you saw a target down there and you said, okay, I need to mark that target, what was your most successful technique to not being shot?
Okay, well, first of all, if the enemy on the ground didn't know that they shoot at you when they think that you know where they are. If they think you don't know where they are, they're not going to bother you, okay? But once you put that mark on the ground for the fighters, the game is up, and now you become the number one target, because if they get you, if they get me, fighters can't drop, so I become the primary person they want to shoot at. So what you want to do is you don't want to ever do the same thing two times in a row. You always want to do something different. And it's also good if you do it very badly. So you do it badly, you become unpredictable. And that's what you want, because that allows you to maneuver and not catch any ground fire hit. So one of the real classic maneuvers that you would do is really easy to do, but it was extremely flexible. You would think you were just going to shoot a rocket. You just want to ease over there and take a shot. That's not really the right way to do it. That's where you get killed. So what you do is you pull the airplane up a little bit, bleed off airspeed and energy, and now you got 4.4 positive G that you can pull in that airplane, and you got the 1.7 negative G, and so you just stick that airplane up there like this, pull the throttles back, the airspeed's dying, and you're losing energy, and now you're up here, and you can do four things in a heartbeat, less than 2 seconds, and you're doing it. You can pull and shoot. You can pull through and shoot back. You can pull over here, kick a little rudder, and slide this way, and blast burst over here. And you do any one of those four in 2 seconds. So now you can see that you've become totally unpredictable. And so you don't even want to do that on a consistent basis. Do something else. Do anything. But don't be predictable, and don't do the same thing two times in a row.
How long was a typical mission for you?
Typically, you run a couple hours, because the problem that you get into is that even if you were you find the enemy and you want to put an airstrike on them, if you're over a couple hours, then you don't have enough gas to stay there and take care of the engagement. So you constantly wanting to be to the point where you could stay for a while. The longest mission I flew was for about four different sorties in one day, for a total of about eight and a half hours. You can hold a lot of rudder pressure with your legs, so after the first couple hours, you need to get some more gas, and you need more rockets and smoke grenades. So you stick it on the ground, walk around a little bit, climb back in the airplane. 10 minutes later, they got it all rearmed, refueled, and you're out again. And I did that all day long. We actually kept the enemy from getting into its sanctuary over in Cambodia, and that gave us a chance then to really put some stuff, tough stuff down on those guys. At the end of the 8 hours, we got credit for 191 KIA, so they're killed by air. And so that was the longest day I flew.
You said you never got any bullet holes in your airplane, but did the airplane ever fail you? Did you?
Well, one of the weak points in that one was the engine. It wasn't the airframe or anything, because you could have, like I say, a stress for 4.4 positive G. So, yeah, that wasn't the issue. Then sometimes the engine, you had some trouble there. We have an airplane down in Fort Worth that we're rehabbing, and it's got the same tail number that tried to kill me about four or five times. And so what it was doing, you'd be flying along, and all of a sudden it's not running. You lose an altitude, the engine's not running right, it's missing, and so forth and so on. And about 40 or 50 feet above the trees, that dumb thing would start going, and you just fly right out of there. And I got a little tired of that, because I was the only person it was doing it with. So at that point, I probably had 350 missions or so, whatever it was. And other pilots I was flying with were starting to treat me like maybe I had a yellow streak in the wrong spot. And so they quit talking to you. They won't have anything to do with you. And finally, one day, one of the other pilots had the same trouble. And he came back. He was really upset about that. And they finally got him calmed down a little bit, and they were talking to him. They asked him what the problem was, and he said this. This was a quote. He says, "Exactly what Fairchild said." And all of a sudden, I had credibility again, which is nice to have. And then all the pilots refused to fly that airplane. So the way we got rid of that airplane was the crew chief took it in his hands, and he got up on top of the Cowling one day. I was taxiing in on another airplane. And he looked like he was up there rubbing a couple of things together. So I shut my airplane down, walked over and talked to him for a second. And I asked him what he's doing up there. And he said, "Well, if it's, I can't fix this thing, I'll just tear it up." So he was grinding up a nail and putting it in the oil. and chain the airplane down and run the engine until he ruined the engine and we got a new one. And, you know, we quit having troubles and that airplane and everything worked well. I was out one day also in another different airplane, and that one, we had a engine malfunction in the sense that a valve keeper came off. We had six cylinders in that engine, and two of them were ruined, and so I'm running on four, and it's got severe vibration. I'm doing really good to hold altitude about 40, 50 feet above the trees. And so if a big tall tree came, you just kind of range the wing up a little bit and let it slide past. And so I was getting, I got back to the airfield. As soon as I retarded the engine just the least little bit, it quit. So I ended up having to dead stick the airplane in on the ground. So engine problems were the real weak point in the airframe.
All right, we're going to move on to the portion of the program that we can't talk about, and that's the sneaky peek, guys, and that's Phil, and Phil was involved in the war. I guess we can't. Well, I don't know what you. I'll leave it to you. What did we call that conflict over there, or could we call it anything? But he didn't operate in Vietnam, from what I understand. He operated west of there, and so I'll turn it over to Phil and give him a quick let him give a quick synopsis of what went on over there. Sneaky Pete, it was what the Sneaky Pete Air Force, isn't that? Yeah, that was the acronym they used, and he was one of them, and yeah, it was classified for a long time. So Phil, describe it.
Thank you, and thank you all for being here today to learn a little bit about the history of the war and what we were doing and so on. I'll give you a little background, and then we'll talk about Sneaky Pete's. I graduated from flight school in 1969 as an Army aviator, went to Jungle Survival School in the Philippines, and then was deployed to Vietnam, and was assigned to the 219th Aviation Company. If you'll notice, my tail number is 219TH. So I have a lot of sentiment toward that particular airplane and that unit. And just so you know, there are three other gentlemen sitting in the bleachers here who were in my unit, and I'm going to introduce them quickly, and then I will tell you a little bit more about one of them. First one is Frank Dougherty. Frank, stand up, say hi. And then we've got Jerry over here. He was with the 219th Aviation Company also. And then we got Rod Stewart back here. He was a headhunter as well. And on my shirt, you'll see two call signs. One of them is the headhunter with the headhunter logo, and the other one says SPAF, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. Now, my buddy Frank Dougherty, Frank and I shared a hooch on the CCC compound, and I'll tell you what that is in a minute, Special Forces compound in Kontum. And Frank has written a book called Only the Light Moves. You can pre-order it on Amazon, and it's specifically about the SPAF mission in Laos and Cambodia, what we did and how we supported the command and control central operation. And I didn't fly many missions in Vietnam. I was assigned to the 219th my whole tour there. And so I flew for the 3rd Platoon for, I don't know, 3 weeks or so. It was kind of boring, to be honest with you. Convoy escorts and artillery adjustment, registering batteries, and looking for stuff that was kind of hard to find. So I wanted something a little bit more interesting, so I asked to be assigned to the 2nd Platoon up in Kontum. And so for the first month or so, I flew for MACV, and what that means, that was the Military Advisory Command Vietnam. MACV, you've heard about that. And that was a more interesting job. And then I met a guy by the name of John Myers, who was a SPAF pilot. And he was a member of my platoon, and he says, you know, why don't you come over and fly our mission? A couple of our pilots are rotating home pretty soon. And we need a volunteer to fly the mission. And as it turns out, every person that was working with Command and Control Central, which was MACV SOG, Military Advisory Command Vietnam, Studies and Observation Group, Special Forces. All of the members of MACV SOG, all of them, were volunteers, including the aviators that supported them. And so we lived on their compound across the river, across the Dock Blau River in Khantum, and we flew for them every day. And Frank and I flew missions together, and dual ship missions, and sometimes single ship missions. And we had several types of missions that we flew. And as Ed said earlier, the mission was top secret. You had to volunteer for it. You had to sign the form that you couldn't talk about it. If you did, you would have an early trip home to some nice place like Leavenworth. So all of the MACV SOG guys were volunteers. And if you were a ground pounder, if you were on a spook team, so to speak, a Sneaky Pete team, they briefed you that you had one of two things would happen to you. You would either get a Purple Heart or you would come home in a body bag. Every member of the SOG teams on the compound that I lived on, every one of them got a Purple Heart at least once. Several of them were killed, and while I was there, there were two Medal of Honor winners living on our compound. And it was an honor to serve with them. And like Ed said a while ago, you got to know the team, you got to know the Americans that were the team leaders. And a team would be two Americans and maybe eight or nine Montagnard fighters. And they were the native hill people. They were wonderful fighters, loyal. And so now we'll get more into the aviation side of it. All of the guys that worked on the ground, they were called Sneaky Petes, the Special Forces guys. So naturally, they gave us a call sign of Sneaky Pete Air Force. Well, we weren't Air Force. We were Army Bird Dog pilots. And the aircraft that I flew over there, there were several of them. They looked exactly like the one you see sitting next to us here.
And that's his airplane, by the way. That is his airplane.
That's my airplane. It belongs to me and my lovely wife, Artie, sitting up there in the stands. And we bought it in 1986, restored it in 87, put it back in my unit colors. It's pretty authentic, so after the program, you're invited to come down and take a look at them.
And the name of it?
It's Saigon T.
Okay. Is there
okay, so there's an interesting question. How many Vietnam veterans do we have in the audience today? Okay, we've got a few. So you know what Saigon T is, right? So if you were an American soldier in Vietnam and you wanted to go into town and maybe have a couple of adult beverages with at a bar and meet a bar gal or something like that to have a conversation with, you would buy whiskey and you would pay for whiskey and you would drink the whiskey. And if the gal wanted a beverage, you would buy her a beverage, but it was tea. But you paid for it as if it were whiskey. And so that beverage was called Saigon Tea. So when I was searching for a name for this particular aircraft, I wanted to give it a name that would identify it with service in Vietnam. Except this airplane never saw service in Vietnam. Almost all of the airplanes that served in Vietnam, the bird dogs, the 01 bird dogs, they did not come home. This doesn't mean they all got shot down or anything, but they were not economically cost effective to crate them and ship them home. So we left them there, and they became pots and pans for the Vietnamese people, and the North Vietnamese got a hold of a few of them and continued to use them. But I put my airplane back into my unit colors, And since it's not the real deal, it's not real whiskey, I called it Saigon Tea. And it has worked, and my wife and I are very proud of it, and we fly it frequently, and it's been a super reliable, fun airplane to fly.
All right, back to the flying now.
All right, so we did not measure our missions by sorties like the Air Force guys did. We just flew our missions, and the hours were logged. And I never kept track. I didn't keep a journal. I didn't even keep a logbook when I was over there because of the nature of the mission was secret. And I didn't even keep letters, you know, back and forth to my wife and so on. We destroyed that kind of stuff. But we flew in Laos and Cambodia every day. We normally flew two missions a day. The missions could last 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, or longer. We carry 40 gallons of fuel in the aircraft, burn 8 gallons an hour. So we have 4.5 hours to fly a mission and 30 minutes to get home. And twice on final approach into Khartoum coming home, I have run out of fuel. Because when you have troops on the ground that are in trouble, you stay with them until you get them extracted and you know they're safe. And then you come back, and I did run out of gas twice on final approach. And I'll make a little side comment here because Ed was talking about the engine that was running rough and the maintenance and so on. I never had an engine failure. In fact, the only engine problems I ever had would be a mag drop, you know, on run-up or something like that. And our crew chiefs over there and our maintenance people were so good and so dedicated. They knew the importance of what we were doing, and they worked. They were at the flight line before we got there in the morning, and when we finished our mission and were drinking beer, they were still working on the airplanes in the afternoon. So my hat is off to them. Frank and the headhunters will agree to that. So we normally flew a couple of missions a day. We were based in Khartoum. We would take off at dawn, and we would head up to a staging field northwest of Khartoum called Dak To. And we would take on a little more fuel there. And there was a CCC little secret mini base there at the Dak To airport where the operations officer would give us our mission or change our mission or whatever. And then if we were flying recon missions without an observer, we would just take off into Laos or Cambodia. And our job was to recon the Ho Chi Minh Trail and areas around it. Now, I don't know. Our AO, was our area of operation, was probably less than 100 miles square in the tri-board area, Vietnam, Laos and Cambodia. So we got to know that area pretty well. And we were either reconning out there, looking for stuff, targets of opportunity, or whatever. The other thing we did is we would find landing zones to insert the Special Forces teams. And then we would mark those landing zones with the white phosphorus markets when the Special Forces teams were in the Hueys and in the air. And sometimes we would mark the real landing zone, and sometimes we would mark a fake landing zone, because the LZs over there in the boonies, they had LZ watchers out there. And they were either sitting up in the canopy on a deer stand with their binoculars, or they were in bunkers along the edge of the LZ waiting for helicopters to come in so they could shoot at them. And so our job was to insert, was to mark the LZs, to bring the teams in, and we normally had a Cobra escort or Charlie model gunships, Hueys, and we would put the teams in. Normally two helicopters would land, the teams would jump off, disappear into the jungle, and then we'd go back to Dak To and wait for the next thing to do. We also did photo missions, low-level photo missions. And when I say low-level, I'm talking 10 to 50 feet off the ground, because we had to see under the canopy. We had to be able to look under the canopy to see if we could find hooches, truck parks, POL, fuel stops for the enemy. As all of you know, the enemy came down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which was inside Laos and Cambodia. The Ho Chi Minh Trail was not in Vietnam, but there were probably 50 different places between the Mujia Pass and the Parrot's Beak where the North Vietnamese would come into South Vietnam to bring in their troops. They normally moved at night. So we did not really fly night missions. There were other Air Force assets that flew the night missions. So for us, for the Army guys, we had to find our targets in the daylight, which was very hard. So when you knew your area of operation and you knew the trail, which, by the way, was not one road. It was a network of roads and trails and paths and rivers and bridges, you know, from north to south. And the North Vietnamese were very resourceful. I mean, you could find a bridge, a bamboo bridge that they moved troops down the night before. You could call in an airstrike on it, blow it up, and go back the next day, and it would be there again. All fresh, new bamboo. Yep. And their anti-aircraft sites, they had a lot of them out there, and they would camouflage them with netting, or they would have these square grids made out of bamboo and weave the foliage in them and place them over the gun sites so you couldn't see them. And talking about, you know, getting shot at, Ed was right. You know, as a sneaky pea pilot, we had various techniques for not getting shot at. And that was we'd usually pretend not to see the target when we flew over it. We'd mark it on the coordinates, and if it was a good target of opportunity, we would pass it, contact the operations officer at Dock To, get Cobras launched, because as Army pilots, we could not directly call up Air Force fighters. We had to go through an Air Force Forward Air Controller, a FAC, to do that. And in our neighborhood, we used Coveys, and they were flying O2s. And if we were a little further north, we might use Nails. And they came out of Nakhon Phnom in Thailand, or they came out of Da Nang. They were flying OV-10s. But anyway, as Ed said earlier, you find a target, you get your helicopters launched, and then the idea is to get over the target and mark it and hit the target and with white phosphorus marking rockets, which is what you see under the wings here. And then the helicopter gunships would come in and use their rockets and mini guns and their grenade launchers out of their chin guns to obliterate the target. If we needed Air Force assets, we would call up the Covey. They would tell us what they had nearby, which was usually F-4s or F-100s. Or if they were coming out of Thailand, we had the AD-4 Sky Raiders. And by the way, there are two of them out there on the ramp, AD-4s, in the exact color of the aircraft that we worked. And we had a pretty good relationship with the FAC pilots. We would communicate with them on the VHF radio. They would tell us what the jets are carrying, which would usually be napalm, bombs, and guns, machine guns of some caliber. And the AD-4s would have napalm and bombs, and they would also carry cluster bomb units, which were in tubes. They were like hand grenades in tubes, and they could drop them, and these hand grenades would fall out and burst in the air a few feet above the ground, and they were really effective at obliterating troops on the ground. And you know, I did not get shot at a lot because we were sneaky Pete's after all. You know, that was what we were supposed to do. We were supposed to not get shot at. But, you know, I think in my whole tour I might have taken 5 or 6 rounds in the aircraft. And if you look at my Harley-Davidson decals on this aircraft, you'll kind of see where a couple of them went through and missed me and my observer. And so most of the time we got home with a couple of stories to tell, and then afterward a few cold beers. And later on during our operations, as the Vietnam War was kind of starting to spool down, and Frank will attest to this, the CCC mission, the SOG mission, was spooling up. Because of the bombing halt and so on, the North Vietnamese were busy moving supplies and building more AA sites. And so we had to be super careful about what we were doing. Now, once we had teams on the ground, one of our other missions was to communicate with them daily to make sure they were still out there, still alive, and track their movements so we knew what was going on. And the teams, they were also sneaky Pete's, and their job was not to get shot at and not to engage in combat. But occasionally they would, and sometimes the teams would have to be extracted. And this is when things got exciting, because when the team called for a spare 3-9er, which was code for extraction, they would call me, and they would not use the code wheel that we used. We used a code wheel to talk to each other, because we didn't want to talk in English a lot of times. And they would come right out and say, "We need a spare 3-9er. Now," and so I'd get the Hueys launched from Doc Toe and get the Cobras launched. Hopefully, get approval from the operations officer on site there to pull the team out. Occasionally, he'd be a jerk and say, "Tell the team to break contact, continue mission." The teams did not like to hear that. But occasionally they had to break contact, continue mission. But usually the operation officer, the S3, would listen to the SPAF pilot. And if the team needed to come out, it's because usually they were being chased, surrounded, already had wounded. And our job was to go in with the helicopters and get them out. And so if they were being chased, the enemy was close at hand. And we would have to bring in gunships to pepper the area around the team. Sometimes we would bring in jets. Usually I like to work the Sky Raiders because they would come in low and slow and they had more loiter time. And there were times, and Frank would attest to this, when we would have the Sky Raiders dropping ordnance danger close. And I'm talking about 50 yards or less from our teams on the ground. Mm-hmm. And we would just tell them, crawl under a log, get behind a tree, something, because we're coming in danger close. And they would ask us to come in danger close because sometimes the enemy was that close. And if they were dropping napalm, we would tell them, "Hold your breath, guys, because you're not going to be able to breathe when the air is sucked out by the napalm." And then after they made their napalm runs, they would drop bombs, and then they would come in with their guns. And when things got quiet, the helicopters would land. But I'll tell you, folks, it did not take the enemy long to regroup. And by the time the helicopters landed, excuse my French, the enemy was pissed. And that was the most dangerous time for us as SPAFs and for the helicopter pilots. And my hat is off to those guys. I watched those guys come in and hover sometimes 10 feet over a poor LZ, and you could see the tracers going through the helicopters and those Special Forces guys climbing up the rope ladders, getting in there, and those helicopters did not move an inch. And we'd get them out, and the helicopters would leave, and fortunately the enemy, well, I don't say fortunately, but usually they were focused on the helicopters more than they were the bird dogs. But once the helicopters DD-mowed, so to speak, they would start shooting at us. And you could see the tracers going by, and you could hear the reports of the rifles. And usually we escaped along with the helicopters, and life was good.
All right. Thank you, Phil. I think we got to go to the third portion of our program, which is the T-28. And Yang Chi, I think, is going to be the guy to talk to us about those patriots of yours that flew these airplanes and fought with these airplanes and put in some incredible time. And, I read briefly about, I mean, they were flying sometimes 10 missions a day. I can't even consider how many hours that must be and the amount of ordnance they delivered. But Yang Chi, go ahead, talk a little bit about, these are the Hmong people. And go ahead, you're on.
I just want to say that I want to thank you all. As I look through all of you here, I want to thank you again for your interest in knowing the history of the secret war in Laos. I want to thank Phil, right, Phil? He has given you the histories of the operations in that part of the world, similar to what the Hmong did. So I'm not going to go through that again, because exactly what you're saying were what we were doing in Laos. During the United States secret war in Laos. The United States secret war began officially from 1961 to 73, but unofficially before that. It was way before that. From General Eisenhower, or President Eisenhower, all the way to President Kennedy, and then all the way to President Nixon, down to Ford, Carter, all this. But anyway, I want you to know that the secret war was was the United States secret war in the 20th century in the country of Laos, while the war in Vietnam was going on. That secret war was kept, or had been kept, secret for 35 years. And many of you, as I said earlier, as I look through this, the audience here, I respect you all, those who served during that war. It was a secret war because the whole thing there began with global interest between superpower countries. Global interest between communism and capitalism. So as the war started way back in 1960, 61, all the way down there when the war was going on in South Vietnam, President Kennedy ordered the CIAs to take charge. That's why we began with the United States Secret War in Laos. The Hmong, particularly, the ethnic groups in Laos with a total population ethnically for like 350,000 out of a population of nation population of 3.5 million people in Laos. But the Hmong were the first one who were chosen, selected by the U.S. government, the CIAs, and the government. Anyway, I want to call those who are lucky enough to be here in our country. And I'm saying here, I'm standing here and saying this because we appreciate what we have done for the country of Laos and also for the country of America, this country of ours. The SGU, would you please stand down up here? Come down here. Okay. Bear with us. This is the first time that we are here, and we are honored that we are being asked to come here to be with you all, those who serve and those who did not serve as well. So, they are little, as you can see. But they served. This gentleman here served when he was 12. And many of this served when they were between 10, 12, 15. They were children soldiers. But it was a war that they were needed to serve. There are two purposes. They serve to protect the sovereignty of our country, then, Laos. the country of Laos. And then secondly, at the same time, simultaneously, as they're serving to protect the country of Laos, they serve the interests of the United States. Okay, so two purposes at that time. And again, Phil has explained everything, what they did with the Montagnard, and the Ho Chi Minh Trail, all this. These people were the ones who, if they had heard what Bill or Phil said, that will make them either happy or sad. We lost 35,000 soldiers, the SGUs. They all have SGUs there. SGU means the special guerrilla units formed by the CIAs. Okay? Not in any other country, only Laos. And only with the Lao and the Hmong in Laos during that war. These medals were not faked. I just want to let you know that they were given by the US Congress way back in 1995, the first time ever in our country of America for the government to recognize their service. In 1995, July 22nd, 20 years after we came to America. Again, they all have these medals because they served in the congressman and the Congress of the United States award them with these medals.
Thank you, Yang Chi. Yang Chi, I see you have more. We're running out of time here. Yeah. If I'd like to talk a little bit about the airplanes, but
I just want you to know that these are the ones who serve on the ground. We have three stages.
I'm going
to
stand up.
Guerrilla
and
unit,
salute them.
Guerrilla war.
Will you stand up and salute them?
Conventional war and air war. So when we come to air war, I will let.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan will tell you, explain to you how sophisticated the T-28 was.
All right.
We lost 727 Americans with the Hmong during the Civil War in Laos. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
I got
that. All right. So, Phil, I'm going to ask you a quick walk around. Can you just come up to your airplane? It's yours. It's been yours for a long time. We
yes,
already
sir.
Talked about the name of it, but anything. It was developed. I think you know they went to Cessna and they said, hey. We need an airplane, and Cessna at that time had a Cessna 170. Of course, it was side by side, and you know they said, "Nah, that's not going to work." They turned it into a tandem airplane and put a little different motor in it, and it's a derivative, from what I understand, of the 170.
Yes, it is. The military needed a new liaison aircraft. They wanted an all-metal aircraft. They wanted one with a powerful engine. This has a Continental 0470-11B, 213 horsepower. Pulls this little airplane off the ground. It only weighs 2,100 pounds, and it carries 40 gallons of fuel and two people. And you can pretty much see what it is, and I know time is a factor, so I did bring my exhibits out here. For people to read after we finish yakking. And then on the other window over there is a specifications chart showing the performance specs of the aircraft, and you're more than happy to read them and learn about the airplane.
All right, thank you. Thank you. And I'm going to turn it over right now to Alan, and he's going to talk. He didn't launch anything in anger off of T-28, but he had everything to do with rebuilding that thing and flying that thing. So,
thank you.
Go
so
ahead.
The T-28 here, much like Saigon T, is not an actual airplane that flew during the war. We've painted up as a memorial to the Hmong who operated this aircraft. A couple things to notice on the tail is the emblem, the three-headed elephant to represent the three tribes of Laos. Hmong. Up on the tail, we have the SGU logo to help represent and commemorate our SGU members. And on the very top, we put a black and white American flag to help symbolize the secret involvement of the U.S. in the war. So this airplane is powered by a Wright 1820s is 1,425 horsepower. And what this was originally equipped with underneath the wings, they'd have rocket pods, bombs, and machine gun pods that the Hmong would go out and attack the Ho Chi Minh Trail with. So.
And how much, what was the acquisition? Where did it come from?
So it was purchased by the foundation. We're a part of the National Lao Hmong Memorial Foundation. We're trying to raise funds to build a memorial for the Hmong in Westminster, Colorado. And we purchased the airplane out of Minneapolis and restored it to look like what they used in Laos. And so we're hoping to make this part of our display very soon.
Outstanding. Outstanding.
So thank you.
And just the training that went, the training to be a Hmong pilot went on in Laos, correct?
Yeah.
I mean, everything happened right there.
Everything happened there. So they would bring in pilots from the U.S. for the CIA to train pilots, the Laos, the Hmong members, on actual missions. So your training was on an actual mission. And you would come back, and then you would train the next group of pilots.
Outstanding. Well, thank you. All right. Again, in the interest of time now, I'm going to open it up to questions. And anything anybody wants to ask, feel free. We're here, and if we know the answer, great. We got one over here in the corner.